Welcome to Rocket Ship, the home of epic React Native content. I'm Simon Grimm, creator of Galaxy's Dev, and today's guest is Charlotte Isambert, developer at BEM Labs, the same company that Alex Moreau worked for, who has been guest on the podcast. So Charlotte, this is the second take of our intro. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad that our connection is no better. We want to talk today about a lot of interesting things that are probably not 100% related to React Native, as you told me up front. But we're going to talk about architecture things. We're going to talk about project management. Not project management, but probably how to work in a project. About one feature flow, experiences from your projects, QR, QC, ship show ask. There are a lot of interesting keywords that you brought up, and I'm highly excited today to dive into them. But first, let's talk a bit about yourself. I said you work at BEM Lab. What are you currently doing? What is your job? What is your current project? Tell us a bit more.
Yeah, so I'm working on lots of different projects because BEM is a consulting firm. So we have lots of different React Native projects. And yeah, currently working on a project for airplanes to monitor their footprint, carbon footprint. So yeah, lots of different tech stack.
Are they using also React Native, or is it just React and then the?
No, React Native with Expo. All of our new projects, we launch them with Expo, of course. So,
Course, everyone's doing this. And I also heard that you're appearing again in Amsterdam in a conference, which is happening, I think, in summer, which is the React Summit.
Yes, I went there last year. So yeah, this year again talking about TypeScript.
Oh, this is going to be interesting. Yeah, I just saw understanding TypeScript, dissecting function type checks in React. Okay, you're way ahead in all things TypeScript in React than I am. But this is actually good for today's podcast, because then you can help me understand a few things more. So as you've worked with different companies, different clients at BEM Labs, I'm pretty sure you learned a lot of things. You had some experiences from those projects. Why don't we start with the architecture? Because you said that for all the projects that you start at BEM, or probably also in the terms of consulting, you have like a consistent architectural framework. Could you describe what this framework looked like? And then we can dive a bit more into like where the principles come from and why it's great.
Yes. So yeah, for all of our projects, we are now using the same architectural patterns. It's been 2 years now, and it was made by our software engineer based on, he's a big fan of architectural patterns, and he took the best out of several one of them and created kind of one that fits great for front-end projects and React Native projects. One main principle we base ourselves on is having modules or features, separate our apps into features. I don't know if that's something familiar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like the whole architecture or models, it's a thing I learned in university, but I quickly learned that in reality, nobody really cared about it because stuff just had to get finished. So I kind of abandoned it, but I recollect some parts of it. So yeah, keep on talking.
Yeah, actually, it takes some time to try to learn them in the first place. But once your architecture is in place, it should not take more time writing some code into it. And it should end up into code that is more readable, easier to maintain. So yeah, the first principle is to separate your code into modules or features. Let me know if anything is boring at one point. I know architecture is not the passion of everyone.
No, that's great.
So yeah, the one first thing is to, instead of writing all of your code, splitting it into components and hooks and having those huge folders with lots of components, we are going to split our apps into smaller folders based on the different features core features of your app. And yeah, I'm not here talking about microservices or monolithic architecture because I don't know them. Those are only for small projects I've seen at BAM. So for teams up to maximum 10 developers. So yeah, the idea is instead of writing all the whole code of your app all together, you split it into smaller bytes based on your different features. For example, if you have, say, a news app, you may split it into, you may have a folder for articles, maybe one for authors, one for subscription to a newsletter, for the onboarding of the user. All of these features, different features of your app. And this way, when a new developer comes to the project, if he wants to work on the article segment, for example, he won't have to focus on, he won't have to read all the code of your app. He will only have to focus on this small part. And it's easier to understand the logic of only this small portion instead of your whole app. So yeah, the first thing we do is split our code into this feature. And these folders have to be based on your business logic. You can have like a module that is called, for example, analytics, because this is not a user feature. This is a service you may be using at one point. Maybe an analogy that I would have for this, because I talked once to a developer on a project I wanted to introduce modules on, because we started to have these huge folders with lots of components. And yeah, this was kind of overwhelming for new developers to come into. And he told me, well, when I have knives, when I clean up my dishwasher, I put the knives with the knives and the forks with the forks. So I want all of my components to be together and all mm-hmm. of my hooks to be together. And at this point, I didn't know what to answer this, but because this seems to be very good points. But I thought about it way too late, and I thought I could have a good answer. So I think it would be if you get to have lots of knives, you don't want to have huge boxes of knives. Maybe then it would be easier to have small pockets of one knife, one fork, and one spoon that you could grab, that maybe children could grab and go on to their picnic. So yeah, this is the idea, splitting your apps into smaller chunks.
This is a great analogy. And it also highlights that, I mean, at a smaller level, if you have like five knives and five forks, you can put like all the knives together and all the forks. But once it starts growing and you have like 20 forks and 20 knives, it makes sense to think about if this is still the best approach. So yeah, this is definitely the best analogy I heard about this before. I took some notes. So I already got a ton of questions. This is like a lecture for me, and I'm learning stuff. So you said you split by feature. Yes. I think you can also split by other stuff. I think there was like the Airbnb style guide some years ago, mm-hmm. and you can split by feature, but what are other ways that you can split by? Like, I think I sometimes in the past split by like page or screen or something. Have you seen other like splitting logics?
So by screen, and then which other categories would you have? Would you have like helpers?
I have like probably yeah, helper, service, utilities, like the standard stuff. I think splitting by feature makes more sense in the case you described, but I just want to say that there are different ways how you could approach this, right?
Yes, and actually those approaches are still compatible. Inside each of our features, we still split things by their type. We still have a components folder, but it's just less smaller because it's only components to show an article or to which are relative to authors, their profiles, etc. It's just a small portion of an app, and you don't get to have a component folder with 100 components inside of it.
So you've kind of like changed the hierarchy of folders, not having components at the top, but the feature is at the top in your case.
Yes, and then inside of it, you have components. And so, yeah, if you're working on authors, you only have to see around. You can just go inside this author folder and you just have to see the components related to this author, not all of the components of your app.
The only problem I can envision right now is that with Expo and file-based routing, I'm gonna have some trouble because like every page in my app folder turns into a route. So have you come across projects where you use Expo Router and wanted to use like splitting this by features?
I've never used Expo Router yet, but my next project I would very much like to. But this I think would not be a problem because pages are just aggregation of components which belong to different features. Usually on a page, if we take our newsletter app, for example, you may have a small portion about the author displaying who wrote this article and maybe the article and maybe a small portion about the newsletter that may belong to the newsletter feature. So pages with React navigation, I can only talk about React navigation. We do have pages which are apart from the modules, which aggregate different components which come from the feature.
Ah, okay, yeah. In that case, it would probably work just fine with Expo Router as well. Yeah, that sounds reasonable. Okay, another question. And by the way, it's funny that I don't know if you've worked with Angular before, but if you work with Angular, you are kind of get this architecture by default. Probably not by feature, but they are enforcing this architecture. And that's the first thing when I switched from Angular to React. I was like, why is there no architecture? Why is there no like CLI creating the file exactly at this position? Because in Angular, you open a project, almost every project looks the same. You have like a pages folder, mm-hmm. a services, a directives, and it's really easy to get into these projects. And that's probably why people like you are bringing these patterns to React, because otherwise React projects are a total mess. I've seen so many different setups of React projects and they all look different. And you always have to go basically through everything if you're new to figure out where the important stuff is. So yeah, there are some good things about Angular as well.
Yeah, this is why we decided at BAM to create this architecture for all of our projects, because we do switch a lot between our projects to go get some help. So it's easier to get into an architecture that is familiar. But I do believe that it's a good thing for ReactNet to impose an architecture because it really depends on the size of your app. If you have a very, very small app, maybe you have only one main feature and you don't want to split your app into features because if you only have 10 components, you don't have to split them. Once I did a very, very small app, it was a web app, only for resetting a password, just a web page, because we couldn't put it into our app, wanted it to be available on the web as well. So it was just a login and a password, and it would not have made sense to get a huge architecture for this one.
Yeah, that's also one thing I really hate about Java. In the past, I learned a bit of Java in university, and then you had like five classes just to expose one variable, and you had an abstract factory and whatever factory here and there, and all these patterns you learn in university. It was horrible. Anyway, so you've used this architecture for your project, and I assume with React Native. So you said in the feature folders, you have then these other subfolders. Could you just give a reference of what these folders are for people who are interested in structuring their React Native apps better? So you probably already said you have like components. What else is in a feature folder included?
Maybe we may have some helpers. Maybe sometimes we have some hooks that are used throughout several components. And also we usually have lots of API calls. So we usually also have some connectors, which make an API call and then adapt the data. So we have some adapters as well. We have some types folders to hold all of our important typings together. Pretty much looks like this, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, that's good.
But yeah, there is another layer that we have, which is based on some architectural patterns and adapted to our needs. We kind of follow the domain-driven design pattern, which is a pattern which focuses a lot on business logic, which puts the business of your app at the heart of your app. And yeah, as I said, the modules names should be features names. For example, analytics should be just a helper, a service that you're using. It should not be a whole module. You would have components to display to your user. It's just a service that you're using. And yeah, so we are using three layers. So yeah, the idea of layers is to split your code into several layers that would each have one responsibility. This way your code is better split. And in the case of DDD, I believe that domain-driven design, I believe that there are four layers. It's for most of architectural patterns. I really don't know them all, but they pretty much always have the same ideas behind their layers names. In our case, we're using three, even though DDD has four. We have the view layer, the business or domain layer, and the infra layer. The most important one is the domain, which holds the business logic. And in React Native apps, in front apps, really, we don't have lots of business logic. But this is the thing that would not change if you completely removed your whole app and started it again in Angular or on a Mac application. It would it would not change. For example, if we take our newsletter app, maybe the business logic would be what an article looks like. The structure, the entity, it would have an header, it will have some content, maybe we would have the maximum length of an article. All of this are things that users know about your app, non-technical stuff about your company or your project. So yeah, this all belongs to the domain, and this is the heart of your app that you want to protect. And that would not change. It would not change based on details of implementation.
Right.
And then you have the view layer, which is everything your user can see and interact with. So all of your components of React and React Native are both belong to the view. So all of your pages, all of this belongs to the view layer. And then we have the infrastructure, which is the interface towards the outside of your app. So if you have external libraries that you're using, all of your API calls, for example, they provide you with data that you can use inside your app, but they're external to the heart of your application. So it goes like this: you have view, domain, and then infrastructure. And inside of all of those folders, so inside the view, for example, we will have our components and some helpers, some hooks, maybe. You asked me which folders I would have. One folder we always have is a services folder. So services are some interface for external libraries that you're using that you may not want to directly use throughout all of your application. For example, we talked about analytics. If you're using a library for analytics, for Firebase or anything, you may not want to use it directly throughout your whole app. First, because if it changes, then you have to change it inside all of your codes. And also because one component from your view, one component may not really care really which library you're using. It just wants to send a log. So you may not really want to have the details of implementation of this library. You may just want to call the send log method, which can be named the same on every project. So usually we have this service folder with, for each of them, a class or a helper, which will give an interface to provide this library.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I've seen the same. I think actually in one of the first episodes I did with Pavel, who was working on like a fitness application. He even used this pattern to like abstract away that he was using Firebase. So many people are using Firebase, but maybe you want to switch away from Firebase at some point, so you can like easily have these this abstract interface before all the calls to Firebase. So eventually at some point you could rip out Firebase and plug in something else while your app is still using the same interface. So I totally see the value in this approach.
Yes, absolutely. And also, for example, React Native Firebase, I believe, said that they would stop relying on dynamic links. They won't support it anymore. So you have to change. You really don't have that much of a choice. And when you do, you're happy to just have to change this this interface rather than your whole app.
So you said you took these, in, let's say, inspiration from design, from domain-driven design, DDD. You took the three layers, not the four they usually have. I'm just not exactly sure like how the final app structure will look like. So in the beginning, we talked about like the model-driven feature-driven. And then we have DDD with like the view layer, the business logic, and the infrastructure. How do these two now come together?
So you have a module or a feature folder. Inside of it, you have all of your features. So article, authors, if we take our example. Then inside each module, you are going to split by the layers of DDD. So you have view, domain, and infra. And inside of them, you have the folders we talked about, which are relevant to these different layers. So in the view, you'll have components, services, maybe hooks, maybe. And inside the domain, maybe you won't have that much components because you're not displaying anything. You're just having some important logic business. So maybe you'll have some types, some entities. And in the infrastructure, it will mostly be API calls. So mostly connectors, adapters to adapt your data. That's something that's important, not to use directly the data that is given by the backend, unless you do have access to the backend and you do make sure that you have the same types in the front and in the back. But in our case, usually the backend already exists because lots of people already have a website and a backend. Mm-hmm. And we arrive and we create a mobile app on top of this backend. And usually we don't that much agree about the types that we should be using, because we want to use types and entities that are close to the business logic as possible. So what we do if we don't have access to this backend and if we can't really change the types, we adapt the data we get from the backend to the entity that we do use in our domain and in our views.
That's really smart. I mean, in many cases, companies just have an API or some sort of backend, and usually they're not willing to change it just because the other team wants to build a marketing React Native application for it. I only know, like, my usual go-to is just copying the JSON response and converting it to a TypeScript interface in Visual Studio Code with a like plugin, and then I call it a day. It sounds like you're doing a bit more elaborate in that in your case.
It depends on if there are lots of chances that things can change. In this case, you're happy that you have this interface you can adapt to.
Yeah, definitely. So we talked 20 minutes about the architecture, and I think this was a really, really valuable insight into like how to structure a good React in general project, but also, of course, a React Native project. I'm pretty sure people are going to love this. I will definitely just stop here and watch it again, because this is really, really helpful for all the stuff I do. I mean, for my tutorials, it's probably sometimes a bit too much, like to set up the features and the DDD principles inside a little project. But for everything that goes like over 5 people working on the same project, I think this is going to be really, really helpful.
Yeah, 20 minutes on architecture. I hope nobody's sleeping by now.
No, I think people will love it. But you also had some, I don't know if it's going to be shorter to explain, but you had some keywords, I would say, that I also wanted to talk about, especially because I don't know exactly what they mean, but it sounded like they could be really helpful. So Tell me more about QRQC and how it helps.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I use these words, because I think that this is a word that we use in our company that may not have a lot of sense outside. Sorry. So yeah, it's quick response, quick control quality, something like this. But what it means, what we do with this, it's just a tool that we're using. Every time we encounter a bug, instead of just and when I first started as an intern in other companies, we just fixed the bug as soon as possible, mm-hmm. and that was it. But what we do is we try to understand why the bug was introduced in the first place, and to not only try to solve it right away, but to try to make sure it does not happen again. And yeah, we got a few interesting ones. Something I'm thinking about is one bug I introduced because it was on the money app, and we were getting this money value from the backend, and it was typed just as a number. And at one point, I used it as in euros instead, but it was in cents or the other mm-hmm. way around. So I just divided the amount of the user by 100 without even realizing it, because I just had numbers everywhere. So if you just fix the bug, you may just think, okay, so yeah, this should not be cents. This should be in euros, and then you're done. But if mm-hmm. you go beyond, you may be thinking, well, maybe I should be using branded types instead of getting numbers everywhere. I could say, okay, so I'm getting a number here, but I'm making sure that this is in cents, for example. And then I have this type which says this amount money is in cents. And so when I want to display it in euros, I know when I'm using it because of its type that I should be converting it to euros. So this is something that came from one of those reflections that we do call QRQC, but not sure if it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, you said quick response quality control. And I think it's, I don't know if there's like an other official word for this, but it's really smart. I can remember at the company where I work, yeah, when we got bugs, like we put them into Jira or in wherever, and then we were assigned and we solved them. We maybe sometimes blamed the person who introduced them if we could look up the Git thing, but it sounds like in your case, it's not about the blame for that person. It's more about learning for. And if you, like, as a solo developer, apply QRQC, how can you make sure that the rest of the team also learns from these things? Simply because you then change, like, the types and say, okay, this is, like, value cents and this is value euros? Or do you have, like, little meetings every week where you talk about these things?
Yeah, we try to share those insights with the teams. It really depends on the project, but the one I'm currently working on, at the daily meeting, after we've all told each other what we're going to do today and share information, we are also sharing what we've learned yesterday, if there is something. And this may be something that we would be sharing.
So you're using the daily stand-up?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can still remember this. At some point, our team got too big and it was like a total mess. But it was always nice chatting to everyone. I definitely think this is a great approach and goes way beyond just fixing bugs. So if you can spend like 5 or 10 minutes to figuring this out, I also recommend this to everyone besides the architecture that you already proposed. But you had more. You had another model, which was called Shipshow Ask. I think it was actually based on an article from someone else. So tell me more about Shipshow Ask. It sounds really like really important.
Yeah, this is really not mine. It's from Martin Fowler, I believe. It's something he proposed for peer reviews, because on my project for 2 years, we did pull request reviews every time, which means if someone wasn't available to review it, you have to wait 2 hours to merge your pull request. And then mm-hmm. you started something else, and if there were some feedback, you had to, some code you had to change, you have some context switching. It's not that efficient, especially for pull requests, which are really easy. There are times when you're not really sure of your code, but really time where you're just changing a color and you really don't need that much of a review. So what he proposes is, instead of always asking for a review or never asking for a review for other teams. He's saying the person who makes a new pull request can give his opinion based on the task. He can either say, well, I know what I did here. This is something that's already standardized in our project. I'm just changing, updating a translation. So I'm just going to ship and I'm going to just... So in our case, we send the pull request into a Slack channel, but maybe you can feature this with directly with GitHub or GitLab notifications. So he's just saying, well, I'm shipping. He's using the keyword ship. So that you know, okay, he's done something we know how to do. There's no need for a review, and he can just merge it right away. If he's not sure at all of his code and he wants to have a review from someone else, he can ask. Then he pauses. He does not merge the request, and we review it. And the middle ground is if it's something you're not entirely sure of, but you're pretty confident, you can. Show it means you're merging it, but you still want people to review it. It's not blocking. They can give you some feedback, and you can take them in another pull request afterwards. And this release made things faster for us, because when you have meetings the whole afternoon and you can't review code for your dev, it's really blocking for them. So.
Yeah, it's totally annoying if you have like changed a ton of things and then you do the PR and then you start on the next thing and I need the code from that. Now it's going to be a total mess. Yeah, this is cool. This is an interesting light model. I think in the past I've been more on the ship side. I'm always confident about my code. Like I'm on the team, my code explains itself. but probably this is a good. Like to have this sort of mental model is important, that you know, yes, you can sometimes chip, yes, you might ask, and sometimes you have this middle ground of showing this. Thank you. Another great recommendation. I like all these little tidbits of information today. And this is not the last one, actually. We have another one, right? There was one more thing that you mentioned that you used in your practice, which was called, or I think actually this is a term you came up with, the one feature flow approach.
Once again, I'm not really sure whether this is a term that's used outside of my company. I'm sorry.
No problem. You're gonna brand these terms. They're gonna be the Charla terms.
But yeah, there. I don't know if it's the right term, one feature flow, but it's. I believe it comes from either lean or agile methods. I don't know which one really, and I really struggle to know what comes from which method in general. But the idea of the one feature flow is we're really into project management now, but it's that you want to. The whole team to focus on one feature at a time when your product owner says, I would like you to add this feature. One mistake that I made a few months ago on a project is that I split it. I had like four developers on a project and I split them into two teams working on two different features in parallel. And I had always been told that it was better for everyone to work on the same feature, different parts, of course, of the feature, but same feature at one time, and then move on to the next one. But I really couldn't understand why, because this is more of something of experience, and this can't really be measured by numbers. So I didn't understand why, because imagine that to make it simple. Imagine you have two developers, each working on a feature A and B that are both that would both take 1 week according to your estimations. I thought, well, I have 1 week. I can just put the first developer on the feature A and second on the feature B. They will both work in parallel, and it will end up taking just 1 week because, well, right. I can just parallelize things. But the things that I've learned, because people were telling me, well, no, it's better for the whole team to be on one thing together. And I couldn't understand why, because, yeah, I thought it would take the same time if they're both working together on the first one for 2 days and a half, and then on the second one. But there are two things that I've learned is that actually it will be faster. Even if you've estimated your both of your features to take 1 week each, if you both of your developers are working on feature A, first, they are going to get a better code base knowledge. So they are going to be able to make better pull request reviews to each other. And then you don't have, as a tech lead, to review all of the pull requests of your team. That's something I had lots of developers on my old project. And besides me, pretty much nobody were making pull request reviews. But as they started to work on the whole part, all of the parts of the app, they started to learn all of the app, and they were able to do good pull reviews then. And the second thing is that if they both work together on one feature, they learn things from this feature that they can then apply to the second one. In our case, it was two pages of a form that were really similar. And it was the first time that we were using optimistic updates. So we were having lots of troubles that we encountered both on feature A and feature B, because we were making the same mistakes on both of those pages. And if we had first done feature A with both developers, we would have learned things from feature A, and then we would have moved on to feature B with all of this knowledge, and we would have been faster. So yeah, the one thing I learned about this is that even if I say it's 1 week for each of them, I can make it faster if they both work together, and then we learn things and we iterate. So it won't really be 2 weeks, actually, if we do. So one feature flow is one feature at a time.
Yeah, I think this can definitely make sense. As you said, if the features have some similarities and like two developers are figuring out something like a complex conversion of something. I just remember in the past we had to deal with like EPUB formats or PDF generation or whatever. And if like both are writing a similar engine, like it could be better if they just work on the one thing and then use the knowledge on the second thing. But at the same time, I think there's even another thing that's probably a benefit of this, is that if they both work on feature A and then both work on feature B, if you have to update something in the future, they're going to know both A and B. Whereas in the other case, the one person might only know what's going on in A and the other in B. So if you have to get into the other thing, you're like, huh, what's going on? I need to get into, I mean, you have a great architecture and you easily know because of the domain-driven design where to find things, but still, it's going to be a bit harder, right?
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, the other thing is that for the tech lead, there are less subjects in parallel. You just have to focus on one and then the other. So yeah, I never understood why, but everybody was always telling me it's better to focus on all of the developers on one epic and then move on to the next one. And I couldn't figure out, because if you just take the estimation, it takes the same amount of time, whether it's parallel or in series. But yeah, I've experienced it, and I'm really very much convinced now. But this only works for small teams. I really don't know how people work on very large teams with monolithics or other kind of architectures.
Yeah, but you could speak from your experience. I think this was really great because you shared some insights that are not just theoretical, but that you learned over the years and that you applied in your projects. And I think this is and was really helpful. To wrap it up for today, I would just love to know if you have some like general recommendations, because you've been in a lot of different React or React Native projects. I think one recommendation is probably to have a decent architecture, but is there anything else you learned over the years in these projects that are like probably even low-hanging fruits that help people to have a better code quality in their React projects? So I guess architecture is the most important piece, you'd say.
Yeah, I think so. Also, yeah, if you keep a good separation within the external libraries that you're using, you can easily switch to new libraries that in the end seem to be better. One thing that we do that is less technical is that we talked about doing problem solving on bugs, but we also do it not only for bugs, but for problems that we encounter on a daily basis. If we see that, for example, someone asked for a review and he had only one the other day, one day delay, we may try for 15 minutes to talk together and see how we can solve this problem. And, you know, ask those five whys to have the answer to a question. You have to ask why five. So, yeah, you are not available. Why weren't you available? Because you are in a meeting all day long. But why were you in a meeting all day long? To get to the bottom answer. This is not really technical. Sorry.
No problem. It's still great. So, thank you, first of all, for all the information about architecture and the different approaches. I just want to know, what are your plans for open source in the next time? Because I think you're super talented, you're highly skilled, and I would love to know, what are your plans for open source? Where, do you want to start new projects or get into some projects? What are you going to do over the next time?
Yeah, I would very much like to get involved into this. Really struggling to try to find first issues to work on. But one thing we are working on with some colleagues is that we do have lots of flows in our apps, you know, flows like onboarding flows or tunnel payments. So sequences of pages where you know the user is going to go to this one page. And we realized that we had lots of bugs related to these kind of flows. So we did some QRQC on those bugs, and we started thinking how can we, for the next app we build, implement better flows, have like a kind of state machines, because you have some flows that are very complex. For example, you may have some steps that are not always displayed, that are displayed only for some users or only once. So one thing we are working on is building a custom navigator, because with React Navigation, I didn't know that, but you can actually easily write new custom navigators for your own needs. So, for example, you have the stack navigator, but bottom tab navigator is another kind. Tab navigator, but which are usually on the bottom, is a custom navigator. And you can actually, thanks to the API that was built, you can actually build other navigators like those ones on your own. So one thing we are working on is building a custom navigator for flows. That's something that we are trying out on our page, and I would very much like to share.
This sounds really interesting. Yeah, I can definitely see a need for that, and I'm happy to be one of your first testers when you get something to release.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jalad, for coming on. Where can people find out more about you if they want to learn more about you, or probably what are the next talks you are going to give over the next time?
I'm really just active on Twitter, and my Twitter pseudo is absolutely terrible. It's because it's my last name, really bad choice. So yeah, C. Eisenberg.
I'm going to put this in the show notes. People can just click it.
Terrible choice. I'm sorry about that. I'm currently only going to go to Amsterdam at React Summit.
No plans for App.js or anything else that comes up?
Unfortunately, no. I wasn't selected for App.js, but it really is. I went last year. It was really wonderful. Lots of great talks. So I would very much like to attend, but yeah, not sure yet.
I wasn't selected as a speaker, but as Galaxy's dev, I'm a bronze sponsor of App.js this year, so I got two free tickets, and I hope I will be there. It's my first time being there, and I'm looking forward to meeting a lot of people from the React Native community.
Yeah, you will definitely enjoy, and it's really nice that you're supporting those kinds of events. Really nice from you. There will be a talk from Delphine, who is one of my colleagues, about yoga. And I have seen it because she gave it internally. And it's really, really nice. So I hope you'll enjoy it.
Yes, actually, just yesterday I went through the talks for AppJS. They look really, really interesting. And I took a note because I think I want to bring on a lot of these speakers. And I took a note, yoga and styling, Delphine Bergner. I would love to bring her here on the podcast as well. So give her already a note that she might get a message from you. Anyway, thank you. Thank you, Jalad, for coming on and talking about these things. People can find all the information in the show notes. I'm also going to put the React Native EU talk in there that you gave last year, I assume, or 2 years ago. And maybe we're going to talk again later this year when you have something new in Orphan SOAS. So thanks for taking the time and see you again in the future.
Thank you so much, Simon.
Bye.